Hello, I'm Amanda Woodard. Thanks for joining me for Best Practice here on RN, the ABC Listen app, or wherever you get your podcasts. So let's look at what's been happening in the world of work. Well, this week we're going to take a look at mentoring versus sponsorship. And joining us to discuss what the difference is and which one offers better outcomes, especially for women, will be lawyer and diversity consultant Susan Price. But that's later in the show. What if the job you have isn't the life you actually want? Mike Lewis listened to his inner voice and then made a truly radical change. Throwing in a prized and lucrative job in finance, he chose to, well, we're going to find out what his real passion was in a moment, and it's a surprising choice. Mike is the author of When to Jump. It's a practical guide to making really big career changes, and he draws on his own experiences. And then he went and interviewed 44 other people who've made some extraordinary leaps. There's the lawyer who became a firefighter, and the garbage collector who ended up being a really good furniture designer. But let's start with Mike's story. What was his jump?
I was growing up as a teenager in a beach town north of Los Angeles, and I discovered the sport of squash. There was a couple courts within probably 100 kilometers of where we lived, and those courts happened to be down the street. And unlike in Australia, squash is very rare, especially west of New York City. I was probably one of five kids that wanted to play competitively on the western side of the United States. And I remember when I was 14, we hosted a professional player who was traveling through town, and he told me about the professional squash tour on playing on mountains in Brazil and cities in Asia and towns that dotted the Pacific. And I thought, at some point, I want to do what this gentleman did. I want to go play pro. And I wanted it because I'd never left the States. I'd never left this bubble. That was a beautiful bubble, but it was still a bubble. And you know, 10, 12 years later, I was in my job. Like you said, I was working at a venture capital firm. On paper, everything made sense. But I realized two things. One was that no one was going to come in and tell me when to go chase my dream. And number two is that this voice in my head, this dream somewhere in my gut of playing professional squash, it was never going to go away. And so I had a very clear choice. I either had to listen to it, which was terrifying, the idea that I would leave something that on my CV looked perfect. My parents could tell their friends proudly that I was a venture capitalist. I could tell folks at the bar or down at my flat, you know, this is what I'm doing with my life. That all made sense. And I had to consider leaving it, which was terrifying. And on the other hand, this idea of not doing anything and going to work every day for the next 30 years and thinking about what could have been. And that ultimately seemed more scary.
I was surprised how many people said to you, don't do it. You know, you're crazy. This job that you're doing now is lucrative. And why would you want to leave that? Which makes me think perhaps that was more expressive of their own fears about doing the same thing. How do you know when what you want to do is crazy and what you want to do is just plain stupid?
It's funny you say that. I believe that the thesis of this book is that there's a difference between crazy and stupid. If you look on social media today or read LinkedIn or other places, you'll see stories of people just waking up one day and starting a company and then selling it to Google, or moving to the Himalayas or Bali and having this beautiful life. And if you follow those types of ideologues, you'll wake up, quit your job, and you'll find that it's actually really hard to make all that happen really quickly. That would be what I would say a stupid idea, to wake up and drop everything and try to move to Bali or start a company and expect it all to work. On the other hand, there are what I call these 10,000 unsexy steps that you don't see on LinkedIn, you don't see on your newsfeed or in Instagram. And that happens to be around planning and saving and budgeting and going through this middle ground that comes after you decide to chase your dream and before the glossed over photo on social media. And I believe if you take those steps, and the book outlines the four phases of making a jump to take those steps, if you do those proper items on your checklist, your jump will be crazy, but it won't be stupid. And I think that's where I got criticism, was people saying, don't just be brash and impulsive. And I said, well, wait a second, I'm actually going to take 2 years to plan this jump. And yes, it will be crazy. And yes, it was crazy. I packed up my life into a bag and I moved to New Zealand, but it wasn't stupid.
Those four steps you describe as part of the jump curve. And the first one is paying attention to that little nagging voice in the back of your head that keeps saying to you, hang on, are you sure you want to be doing this?
Exactly. In the first story in the book, of which there are 44 stories sectioned off by these four phases, we talk about the little voice. It's a karate school manager who turned into a screenwriter. He had failed continuously and told by many around him, even his loved ones, don't do this. And he ends up writing Sleepless in Seattle. He was a middle-class Jewish kid from Pennsylvania. The next woman in the book in the same section describes the same type of little voice, but she was totally different. She was a single mother in her 40s who was a nurse that wanted to be a doctor. She became one of the oldest doctors to go through the Mayo Clinic around 50 years old when she got her diploma. And I think that the point here is that we all have a voice. It's just super hard to take out the other distractions and noise that come with apps and notifications and our day-to-day commutes and our families. But if you tune in, and that's what this first phase talks about, if you silence the other noise, you'll be able to start to pick up to that voice that you know is nagging you, like you said, and that won't go away. And you can start to listen to it. And that's the first phase.
And planning then is the second phase. You've made that decision in your head anyway. Why is it so essential then to step back and be thoughtful about the process?
Well, I think the process is everything. This is, again, a thought out gradual decision to jump. And the book really emphasizes that, which is it's going to take, like I said, these 10,000 unsexy steps. So this section, Make a Plan, really hammers in on what it is like to plan through three core pillars. Number one, the financial planning. Most people can't wake up one day and quit their job. They need to have an income, a paycheck. They may have a spouse, a family, a mortgage to account for. So the financial planning is key. For folks thinking, well, I don't have the money, what I would say is, do you get a flat white every day? Do you stop by and get a croissant on the way to work or at the bus? If you put that money away, $5 a day becomes $2,000 a year.
I know, my husband tells me that all the time.
Right.
On RN, this is Best Practice, and I'm Amanda Woodard, and my guest is Mike Lewis, author of When to Jump, If the Job You Have Isn't the Life You Want. Mike, the book is full of so many good stories, and I've got my favourites, as I'm sure you have. I particularly liked Greg Klassen, who is a garbage guy who reinvented himself as a furniture designer and a very successful one. But what I particularly like about his story is that he really had to face sacrifices. I mean, he went in with a new baby. He hadn't been married that long and he had a lot of college debt. Now, that takes a lot of guts, I think, because I think it's fair to say some of the people who featured in the book have had quite a secure financial background before they took that jump. But Greg went in with both feet really into an abyss, not knowing whether he was going to make it or not, and was full of self-doubt. But he came through. What are one of your favorite stories?
One of my favorite stories is of a young woman. She's in her late 30s. She's a single mother. Her daughter is around 8 or 9 years old. And she actually contacted me after a radio interview I gave a year before the book came out. And she lives in Boston. And she said, you know, today's my last day as a marketing executive. And she had actually gone to a recovery program called Alcoholics Anonymous to become sober from a battle with alcohol. And what she found in these treatment programs was she loved writing because she could express herself. And now, the day she heard my interview, she wrote to me saying, I'm taking this jump to become a writer. And what she says, and her name is Laura McCowan, and she's now in this book, she describes what she very beautifully conveys as the difference between asking for permission and asking for support. And what she says is that if she looked for permission from her ex-husband, from her parents, she may never get it. Because there's always going to be someone who says, that's not right. You shouldn't go do this. That's crazy, right? And instead, when she decided to jump, she said, I'm not looking for permission. I'm looking for your support. And she had her own set of items to deal with, some debt, uncertain financial future, a daughter. And she jumped because she didn't wait for permission. And by asking for support, she got it. And that was critical to have people in her corner, but she no longer needed their permission.
that single-mindedness that you've described really shines through in several of these stories. I mean, another one is Brenda Berkman, who qualified as a lawyer and then followed really what was her childhood passion, which she'd always wanted to be a firefighter in the New York elite firefighting group. And she wasn't allowed to because she was a woman. She thought that was crazy. But she pursued that. And what is so inspiring about her story, I think, is that by following it through and getting knocked back and even winning, she took them to court, didn't she? She took and won the case. But even after that, she faced harassment and discrimination. And it isn't really a conventional happy ending, that story, but because she had a really hard time. But nevertheless, she doesn't regret it one bit because it not only benefited her, but she can see that it benefited the wider community by doing that, by taking that jump.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's it's a great story for your listeners here who are thinking, well, what if it doesn't go to plan? And she, Brenda, is a heroine in many ways because she pushed forward for women's rights. She did something she thought was just, but it didn't come with a happy ending. You know, she faced a lot of discrimination, a lot of challenges up until her retirement. And that's a great example of saying, you know what? Some jumps won't end the way you think, but that doesn't make them not worth doing. There's still a worthy cause behind it, even though they might be unpredictable, even up through the conclusion.
And I think it's also worth saying that jumps don't have to be big jumps, do they? They can be small jumps, but just as effective.
Absolutely. Of the 44 stories, we have folks who have pursued lifestyle jumps, side jumps, internal jumps, moving within a company, folks who are saying, you know what, I like my job, I like my life, but I'd like to learn a language on the side. I'd like to volunteer more on the weekends. I'd like to be around my family more when I can. I'd like to travel once a year somewhere different. And so I think the book actually becomes one around saying you can take agency over your life. You can have control over the decisions that are coming up rather than life telling you where to go. And I think that's what taking a jump is. They come in all shapes and sizes, and that's certainly what we've seen in the 44 stories here in this book.
Mike, thank you so much for coming in. It's been fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mike Lewis. His new book is When to Jump, If the Job You Have Isn't the Life You Want, and it's published by Hachette. You'll find details on the Best Practice homepage, abc.net.au/rn. On RN, online or podcast, this is Best Practice, and I'm Amanda Woodard. Having a mentor, someone in your corner who can help you navigate the world of work with some sage advice can be a really big help for your career. But is it better, especially for women, to have a sponsor? And what's the difference? Why might sponsorship lead to better outcomes? Susan Price is a lawyer and diversity consultant, has some really interesting views on this.
With mentoring, I think traditionally we think of it as an older, wiser person imparting their knowledge to a junior, more experienced person and really helping that junior person navigate the path that they're currently on. Sponsorship's something quite different. Someone once said to me, mentoring is you're in the room with someone and they're telling you what to do. Sponsorship is actually you're not in the room with them and they're talking about you, recommending you to others. So quite a different dynamic in that sponsorship relationship.
And do you think there are differences in how men and women both perceive and experience mentoring?
Yes, I think there are. And I'll just caveat this by saying, of course, this is a generalisation and there'll be men and women who will have experiences quite different to this. But I think conventionally, male relationships with both mentoring and sponsorship tend to happen quite spontaneously and organically. And often they've arisen in the context perhaps of a sporting team or a school connection. And those relationships really get fostered without much work going into them on either side. For women, I think in particular, mentoring has been seen as a bit of a way to improve the confidence and skill set of women. And it's again trying to help women navigate in a world that it's seen as unfamiliar for them or that they don't quite know what the rules are. And I think in some ways that hasn't really been helpful because it's almost been seen as fixing the women and helping women navigate in what essentially is a man's world.
you're implying that mentoring hasn't worked as well as perhaps it might have done for women. How can sponsorship improve upon that, do you think?
I think one of the things that probably every large organisation has done as part of its diversity agenda has been to introduce a mentoring program. Again, based on the premise that to get ahead, women needed to understand the rules of the game, and they could best do that by learning from an older, usually male mentor. That really, again, comes from this sort of deficit model that women don't understand the rules of the game. Sponsorship is completely different because, of course, sponsorship says the game is what the game is. I'm not going to tell you how you should play the game, but I'm at least going to get you on the field. And that's quite different from mentoring. Mentoring doesn't necessarily create those opportunities or openings for women perhaps to get promoted, have access to great jobs. Of course, mentoring can lead to a sponsorship relationship. But mentoring really, I think, is limited in that idea of imparting the mentor's knowledge to the mentee, when often their life experiences and backgrounds can be very different.
So, Susan, tell me about your own experience of sponsorship.
I was working at a law firm here in Sydney, really quite preoccupied because I had very young children. I was studying to retrain into the area of law I was practicing in. I was really just, to be honest, getting by, turning up, putting my head down and doing my work. One of the partners in that law firm, a wonderful man called Graham Cowley, was a fantastic sponsor for me and also for a lot of other people in that firm. It would be very common for Graham to go and have a business lunch, and you'd hear him walking back through the office, handing out his business cards. And he'd say things like, "Susan, I sat next to this bloke at lunch. He needs some advice. Give him a call." Now, it wasn't Graham saying to me, "I can introduce you," or "let me set up a meeting." The contact had been made. Graham had credentialed me with that potential client, and it was then up to me to really make the connection and do the work. He opened a lot of doors for me with clients. I ended up becoming a partner in that law firm, and I suspect largely at Graham's instigation. It wasn't something at that time I was particularly seeking. And even many years down the track, it was Graham who rang me and said, "I'm stepping off a not-for-profit board. I've said they should appoint you," and I'm still sitting on that board.
Now, I'm sure some people listening to that will think, wow, she's lucky. Isn't really sponsorship just another word for favouritism?
On one level it can be, and I think there's no doubt that as human beings we tend to seek out people that we like working with or people that we have a particular affinity with. I think sponsorship, when it's informal and it's unchecked, can in some ways look like a bit of favouritism. And often the sponsor and the person who's being sponsored wouldn't even necessarily recognise it as being a sponsorship arrangement. Certainly, if you're not sponsored and you're seeing others in your organisation getting opportunities, being taken to meet clients or have access to work that you're not getting, it very much feels like you're missing out in some way. And I think that's where there's a role, first of all, for examining the informal sponsorships that occur in organisations and thinking about whether, in fact, you can put in place a more formal sponsorship program.
Given what we've said about sponsorship then, do you think there is still a role to be played with traditional mentoring programs?
I think there is still a role for mentoring, whether it's at an organisational level, I'm not so convinced. But I think certainly at different times in my career, I've really benefited from seeking out older, wiser, more experienced people and seeking their advice, not necessarily in a formalised mentoring program or arrangement. I think as you get older and perhaps more confident and you know more people, you feel very comfortable picking up the phone and asking to have a coffee, chat through a thorny issue. I think there's definitely still a role for those kind of relationships. But I think the idea that a mentoring program in and of itself will help you fix an issue you may have with the representation of women in senior leadership ranks, I think that's quite an outdated idea.
Like you, I've had experience as a mentor, but increasingly we're seeing the idea of reverse mentoring coming into the workplace, which I'm sure I could benefit from. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, reverse mentoring is a really interesting idea, and I think one that is open to be used in a lot of different ways. So this really turns the traditional mentoring relationship on its head. And instead of having the older, wiser mentor imparting their knowledge to the more junior and experienced person, it's flipping that idea. Now, I've seen it done, first of all, in the guise of an IT mentoring program where younger, more IT-savvy members of the workforce are educating their older colleagues on the use of social media, handy tips on using your laptop, all of those kinds of IT ideas that perhaps an older generation aren't as familiar with. I've also seen it used very successfully just to break down barriers in an organisation between senior staff and a junior, more diverse cohort of employees. And again, it's that idea that just by getting to know someone and spending some time hearing about their experiences, the older person gets a bit of an insight into that employee's life. And interestingly, those reverse mentoring relationships can go on to become sponsorship arrangements simply because the program of reverse mentoring has given the parties an opportunity to get to know each other.
If anyone listening to this is thinking, that's a good idea, I'd like to become a sponsor, what's involved and how do you make sure you do it well?
I think for some people, sponsorship comes quite naturally. And certainly thinking back to Graham Cowley, part of it was his generosity. So generosity of time, generosity of sharing his contacts and his connections. So I think for anyone's thinking that they'd like to really improve on how they were sponsoring others, look around the circle of those people that you work with or you come into contact with, and the first step is simply thinking, who could I introduce them to? Or if you're asked to do something, say to speak at an event or to give a presentation, think for a moment about, well, yes, I'd love to do that, but perhaps I can also suggest someone to take that opportunity in my place. And that's a really easy way just to start developing that relationship, which is really all about creating opportunities for others as opposed to keeping them for yourself. Of course, a sponsorship relationship is a two-way street. And again, in the same way you can't really force someone to be a sponsor, if someone doesn't want to be sponsored, they'll pretty soon let you know by not returning your calls or emails usually.
And on the other side of the fence, if you were giving advice to a younger person who'd say, wow, I would love to have the benefit of the assistance of a sponsor, any tips for them on how they might encourage that?
Again, I think the first step I'd say is have a look around your network. And I, you know, when I started out as a young lawyer, the very mention of the word networking used to just horrify me. And I had this vision of people in a room shaking hands and handing around business cards. Again, Graham Cowley taught me a really important thing, which is networking is just simply thinking about how can I help other people. So as a younger person, I'd be thinking, who in my sort of circle of extended connections through work, through the social clubs I might be in, through sporting clubs, who do I know who's actually taken a bit of interest in me? And how can I start to ask them whether they might be prepared to continue to do that? And the first step, look, who doesn't love a coffee invitation? So ringing someone up, texting them, saying, would you like to meet, have a coffee? That's the first step. But again, I think whereas mentoring often happens within organisations or even outside, sponsorship, you've got to think about who is in a position that can really help me.
Susan, thank you so much. Those were really interesting insights.
My pleasure.
Susan Price, lawyer and diversity consultant. And that's Best Practice. The programme is produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer was Hamish Camilleri. And I'm Amanda Woodard. Thanks so much for your company. Bye-bye.